Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee for February 21st. We have three bills on our agenda today, and we will probably run through our committee time with the number of testifiers on a couple of these bills. So we will ask our testifiers to be expeditious today. Our first bill up this morning, we need to do a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Szymanski.
Present.
Representative Mazerall.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson. Representative Champion.
Yes.
Representative Cornish. Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Kreisel.
Here.
Representative Lane. Representative Lesh. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Shoemaker.
Here.
Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Swazinski.
Here.
Representative Vogel.
Here.
Representative Wardlow.
Present. Okay. The quorum is present. Minutes from the previous committee hearing. Would someone like to move the minutes of the previous meeting? Representative Vogel moves the minutes of the previous committee. Any discussion to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Representative Woodard presenting Senate file 1236. Good morning, Representative Woodard.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed with your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate file 1236 and House file 1418 is the bill that we heard in this committee last year that was laid over. It applies to corporate successors with asbestos-related liabilities from a pre-1972 merger or consolidation and stipulates that the successor could not have stayed in the asbestos business after the merger or consolidation. You know, 1972 is the critical year because OSHA issued its workplace regulations related to asbestos for the first time. And after 1972, a company would have recognized that occupational exposure to asbestos was potentially hazardous and would simply have kept an alleged asbestos-tainted company as a subsidiary, thereby limiting its potential liability to the value of the subsidiary. So what this bill does is restores fairness to these innocent successors while providing the plaintiffs, allegedly harmed by a predecessor, can collect no more from the successor than they could have collected if the merger if no merger had occurred. The amount of the predecessor's total gross assets at the time of the merger plus an upward adjustment to reflect what those assets would be worth now after inflation plus a 1%. This only applies to cases after the date of enactment. That's one of the amendments we put on as a result of discussions in this committee to make it prospective instead of prespective. So, Mr. Chair, that's the bill before us.
I agree. Thank you, Representative Woodard. I understand we have someone who would like to testify on this bill. And I would remind you, we do have a full schedule. Please come forward. And we have heard this bill in our committee in April of 2011 as House File 1418. So I would ask you not to, retrench the entire discussion, but give us a summary, please. And please keep it to two or three minutes at the most so that we can
thank you, Mr.
continue
Chairman,
there.
And members, think Susan Vento will go first. Keith Gustafson, and then I'll just have brief comments at the end.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Vento. Would you please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, I will. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Susan Vento. I'm a resident of Maplewood, Minnesota, and I am the widow of the late Bruce Vento, who served in this house for 6 years and in the U.S. House for 24 years. 12 years ago, right now, Bruce was waging an all-out effort to beat the odds against mesothelioma, a cancer caused by asbestos. And I'm going to do my best to try and not be redundant and repeat what I said last spring, but there will be a portion of it that will be repetition because I don't think this story can be told often enough. Prior to January of 2000, mesothelioma wasn't a part of our vocabulary. We couldn't say it, we couldn't spell it, and it took a few days to get to the point where we felt comfortable using it in our vocabulary. Suddenly, in late January of 2000, it became a regular part of our lives. and a major part of Bruce's life and the lives of his family, his friends, and his colleagues. Although he did not work directly with asbestos himself, he was exposed to asbestos in work settings on the east side of St. Paul in the 60s, where he worked to support his family and to pay for his college education to become a science teacher. I'm here today to urge you to consider the impact of this legislation on those who suffer from illnesses, including excruciating and fatal forms of cancer caused by asbestos, as well as the impact on their loved ones. It used to believe that asbestos-related diseases afflicted those who were elderly, those who had experienced direct and prolonged exposure to asbestos, and those who were military veterans and laborers. Since Bruce's death in October of 2000, just 8.5 months after his initial diagnosis, I've had the opportunity to work with medical professionals, patients and families, and other advocates to address issues related to asbestos and mesothelioma at the state and national levels. It's been a stunning learning curve. I've learned that asbestos exposure can and does occur in many settings, in buildings, office buildings, and construction sites, in schools, homes, and neighborhood settings, even parks. I've been struck by the number of men and women, both young and old, who never worked with asbestos themselves, but whose illnesses were caused by secondary exposure. Two women come to mind, both named Mary, both exposed by their fathers who unknowingly brought asbestos home at the end of their work days on their clothing, hair, and skin. Their fathers outlived their daughters, Mary. Since Bruce's death, I've come to know many mesothelioma patients who, thanks to wonderful medical advancements, have outlived the odds. Just a few weeks ago, I attended a celebration for a young woman who's not yet 40, who had reached her six-year milestone since her diagnosis with mesothelioma. It was a wonderful celebration. However, her life and the lives of others who've outlived the odds have been impacted in terms of medical care and costs, quality of life, and ability to continue to earn an income. Although the bill is entitled the Innocent Successor Asbestos Related Liability Fairness Act, it focuses on the interests of not just one successor company, but any and all that fall within the terms outlined in this proposal. Having seen mesothelioma up close and personal, I can tell you that the innocent are truly those diagnosed with asbestosis, mesothelioma, and other cancers. It alarms me that although this bill has the word fairness in the title, it is anything but fair in that it focuses on the interests of a company or the plural form of that word without regard to those whose lives have been devastatingly and forever impacted by asbestos. Before you vote, please consider the following questions. Isn't it troubling that the Minnesota legislature is on the verge of passing a bill that bows to the interests of Wall Street that would eliminate the legal rights and ignore the interests of Minnesotans who work, live here, pay their taxes here, raise their families here, and will be laid to rest here? Where in this legislation is there consideration for the traumatic medical and financial impact of the lethal diseases caused by asbestos? How does it account for the significant costs for medical care and loss of income? If these companies are not responsible for their actions, who is? In closing, if you consider this legislation from the perspective of patients and their families, it creates disturbingly and still unanswered questions. I urge you to vote no. Thank you very much for listening to and considering my concerns.
Thank you, Ms. Vento. Other testifiers?
Keith Christofferson. I'm the business manager with the Heat and Frost Insulators, Local 34, also known as the Asbestos Workers, Local 34. I also spoke last year in front of the committee, and I appreciate your time again this morning. I'd just like to point out a few things, and I did bring them up last year. It's very ironic that this bill has the word innocent in it, because the only innocent people here are the workers that work for the company without knowing what asbestos did to them, and they're the ones that suffered from the disease, they suffered from the sickness, and their families are the ones that had to watch them die a painful death. The company did not have to handle what was happening amongst their employees, because even at that time the workman's comp was completely different. It didn't have the teeth in it that it has nowadays. And unfortunately, the families are the ones that continue to suffer. I pointed out last year the amount of asbestos that's in this building alone. You can walk the halls, and what I would really encourage you to do is go down to the mechanical rooms, and probably 50% of the materials in this building contain asbestos. Asbestos does not pick political parties. It doesn't care if you're a Republican. It don't care if you're a Democrat. It doesn't care if you're an independent. It treats everybody the same way, and it kills everybody. Since taking office in 2003, the number of funerals that I have gone to, as of January of this year, I've gone to 55 funerals. 25% of the funerals that I have attended for my members have been because of mesothelioma or an asbestos-related disease. When you watch these people who are 200-pound grown adults, 250-pound grown adults, and by the time they die, they're 98 pounds, 95 pounds, 80 pounds, because it just eats them up. And the only result that they have is when they're laying in the hospital bed and their lungs can no longer work properly, they fill up with fluid and they basically drown. So to call the company innocent at this point is very ironic. I think we need to consider what it does to the people that it affects. It could be your family, it could be your children, it could be yourselves, just depending on whatever walk of life you choose. And to accept somebody from taking on the responsibility that they took when they purchased the company, knowing what the laws were, obviously it was a good business decision at the time. That hasn't changed. The company has continued to make money. When they banned asbestos in 1972, that didn't mean they could not use it anymore. Knowing that the laws were going into effect, the companies warehoused the material. They stocked the material. And the way the law worked was, yeah, you couldn't produce it anymore after 1972, but if you had it in your warehouse, if you stocked it, if you had it on hand, you could use it until every piece of it was gone. As far as 1978, 79, there were still asbestos products being used in the buildings that we live in now. So I urge you to vote against this bill. It's not about a company, it's about the people the company represents. Thank you.
Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here for the Association for Justice. I got a little gravel in my voice today. Sorry about that. Mr. Chairman and members, this is, as we know, is a model bill from the American Legislative Exchange Council. It has been introduced in several states across the country, and it is an unprecedented attempt by the legislature to be both judge and jury. For the first time in the history of this state, we are saying that a corporate defendant is innocent. We've taken no evidence, we've examined no witnesses, we've reviewed no documents, and this bill says that we are going to determine that this company is innocent, something that all the courts across the country have failed to do. In every instance where Crown Cork has paid a claim, they have asserted their innocence. Not a single court has found that yet. They were a knowing participant, and I have to tell you that if you look at the bill and you look at the language, first of all, it's extremely confusing, but if you look at it, you will see that we are not absolving them of their unknown liabilities that they claim to have assumed. But if you look on page 2, line 2.4, we are absolving them of their liabilities, whether they were known or unknown. We're absolving them of their known liabilities that they assumed at the time of the merger. Mr. Chairman, I believe that this bill absolutely puts the legislature in the wrong place of trying to determine someone's guilt or innocence. I don't think the legislature is appropriately equipped to do that. And if you are going to make that step, I would urge you to look at the court filings, talk to the witnesses, look at the depositions that have taken place, all of which have found that the company was not an innocent successor, and I believe that this language will absolve them not just of their unknown liabilities, but clearly absolves them of their known liabilities that they assumed at the time of this merger in 1964. We appreciate a no vote and the committee's caution as you move forward with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I am remiss. We did not move the bill before the committee. Would someone like to move Senate File 1236?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Now we have the bill appropriately before our committee. Questions from the committee? Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question was for the author.
Okay. Would the author please come forward? Representative Woodard? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was simply, it might have been addressed by the testifier, but I just wanted to ask you, Mr. Representative Woodard, if this was an ALEC bill.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I believe ALEC does have a bill like this. So does the Council on State Governments has this as a model legislation. So that's one I think we're all familiar with as well. The purpose of bringing this bill forward has nothing to do with that organization. And Mr. Chair and committee, I feel like this is the House Un-American Activities Committee, but I am not and have never been a member of ALEC.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Woodard. And I just would like to ask for a roll call on this bill.
All right. The roll call is noted. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the testifier, Mr. Carlson.
Morning.
Grunhagen.
Morning.
We've had numerous
Grunhagen,
conversations over the last year and a half on different issues. But, hey, I empathize with the people who've lost loved ones, and I understand that, you know, losing a loved one for any reason is extremely depressing and emotionally distressing. I understand that. However, when I look at this particular case, I think that, I do think in lawsuits in general, there needs to be some reasonable and rational limits to the liability of a corporation. And when I look at the summary here, I mean, they owned the company for 90 days. And again, appreciate your feedback on this, Mr. Carlson. They owned the company for 90 days. The way it reads, it looks like they paid about $60 million for the Munda division. They owned it for 90 days, and then they've paid out $700 million in claims nationally. I know not in Minnesota. We also have more than a dozen states where I assume that Crown Cork operates have passed similar laws, because this is causing a hardship on the company in terms of operating costs, high interest rates to borrow the money to expand or grow their business or maintain it. And I do think there has to be a balance between the company's liability and the hundreds of employees that they employ here in the state of Minnesota, which if Crown Cork decides to leave, if I remember right from last year, they employ about 400 people, and Representative Woodard can clarify that, in the state of Minnesota. And if those people lose their jobs due to unlimited liability for a decision that was made over 30 to 40 years ago, I think, you know, there's an unintended consequence of misery that's inflicted there. So I agree companies need to be liable, but I do think certain reasonable limits need to be put on that liability so that we don't endanger and chase corporations out that are employing many of our citizens. Your response, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And Representative Grunhagen, no one wants to put undue liability on a corporate defendant that is not deserved. But my point is this, Representative. We don't know that they operated that company for 90 days. We have nothing in front of us that tells us that. We don't know that they have had a higher interest rate because of that. In fact, if you look at their SEC filings, they're doing quite well. This is an $8 billion company with 22,000 employees worldwide. Their bond rating is excellent. So when you say they've suffered that, we don't know that. We don't have any evidence in front of us of that. If you look at their SEC filings that they filed with the Security Exchange Commission, you will see in their notes that they file with the government that resolution of asbestos claims will have no adverse material effect on the company. That's what they filed with the government. That's what they tell their investors. Resolution of these issues will have no adverse material impact on the company. And so my point is not that we want to have a company pay liabilities that they are not responsible for. But my point is that we are finding them innocent without any information, any documents, any witnesses. Nobody went under oath here and said, oh, that's right. Because I think when you peel back the onion, you're going to find out a different story. And that's our problem with the way the legislation is drafted. We don't want any company to pay for liabilities that they have not appropriately assumed, which we believe Crown Court did when they purchased Mundet in the early 60s.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Representative Woodard, would you respond? I just remember we had the owner here last year, and some of his testimony or comments that were made, I don't completely remember, but would you shed some light on some of the statements?
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gruenhagen, unfortunately, they're not here to testify, but you're correct. That is what they testified to when we talked about this bill last year, I believe in April, before this committee. I think it's important to note, too, that when we look at this is a terrible, nasty thing, mesothelioma, as well as asbestos itself. But this is a different case. This is about companies who really are innocent successors. This was in the case that we're talking about now, where Crown Cork and Seal testified they purchased this company in 1964 and never manufactured asbestos. Also, there is the GAO report from the feds in 2011 stated that there's over $39.6 billion in trusts from companies that have been bankrupted. That is paying out on these claims. So there is money for people who have suffered from this, and that certainly, that $39.6 billion is considered by the GAO to be sufficient to cover these claims that are legitimate claims.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Woodard. Representative Lesh, before you speak, I would remind the committee once more that we did hear this bill thoroughly last spring, and we'd like to move this process along. So,
Representative Lesh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last spring was so long ago, and my age is affecting my memory, I think. But I do remember, I don't think he was the owner last year. I think he was the chief counsel or something. The colorful character that we had last year who was great, and Representative Woodard, I wish you would have brought him back because he was fantastic. Very entertaining. And I thought about it when I listened to Representative Gruenhagen's comments about really, he's just trying to improve his company, and why is it that a company should be subject to unlimited liability? And I thought, well, really, the entire point of incorporating in the first place is to avoid liability. So if you're really looking to shrink liability for your company, go get on a board of directors. But if you're looking at trying to protect the interests on the other side of that spectrum, the workers who are affected by a company's actions, well, then you serve in a legislature. Because we're here to limit the scope of what a company can do when they incorporate for the purposes of avoiding liability. If you're on the board of directors, you try to say, well, we shouldn't be liable for this. If you're in a legislature, you say, well, hang on a second. Avoiding that liability by incorporating should have certain limits, especially when there are ongoing impacts 30, 40 years down the line. And I'm trying to figure out other ways. I'm sure there are other ways that I could benefit from changing legislation when I'm not getting the answers that I want in the courts. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for, I know we've already heard this, and I appreciate you giving the opportunity to speak on it, but I just can't get around that fact that by virtue of the fact that you once upon a time we had an individual who was personally accountable for the welfare of the business, of their workers, for their profits, and now when you can incorporate, you put that into a fictitious entity, which now the Supreme Court says is actually a person, and you can avoid that liability. Well, what's stopping that? What's stopping it is supposed to be the courts, and then when the courts are having trouble, you're having trouble ramming it through in the courts, you go through the legislature. So I think that Mr. Krasinowski was pretty frank last year when he spoke, Representative Gruenhagen, noting that there was a cloud of asbestos-related liabilities affecting his ability to expand and affecting his standing on Wall Street. While he was speaking, I was thinking about the standing of families like Ms. Vento's and the other families who testified, and I thank God that I'm here in this room and not in the boardroom of a corporation that's looking to avoid those liabilities.
Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just a comment as well. You know, as a member of the judiciary, I guess my main responsibility, I'm not an attorney, but just think about what my role is that that's to help ensure that individuals have access to the courts and have a chance to hear their cases heard for whatever reason. And this case seems particularly egregious in as much as we have someone who has become sickened by a horrible disease and they want to make a claim. It seems the least that they should have is the opportunity to go before court, make their claim, present their evidence, and let the court or a jury decide what the outcome is. But to pass a bill that says they don't have the opportunity to do that just seems, I mean, I can't see anything much worse than that. I mean, this is just a horrible piece of legislation that just overly weighted towards big corporate powers and sticking it to the little guy.
Okay. By Representative Woodard. Okay. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I think I should just pass. You seem to have 30 testifiers lined up in the next 75 minutes, so I don't want to take the time to ask the question. But I did hear Representative Liebling ask if this was an ALEC bill, and I heard the author muse that was this the House Un-American Activities Committee. My ears perked up. I was going to ask the chair, do we have a House Un-American Activities Committee, and how does one get on it?
Yeah.
But in as much as we have 30 testifiers, I won't ask the question.
All right. Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Gruenhagen, did you?
I'll pass.
You'll pass? All right. Representative Gruenhagen then renews his motion that.
Roll call.
Yes, Representative Johnson. Representative Woodard.
Mr. Chair, just a very quick closing statement because some comments were made about Wall Street. And if you don't like Wall Street, this is the bill for you. What Wall Street has done to this company is required insurance reserves because of this successor liability that they currently face when it comes to these asbestos claims. So this is about sticking it to Wall Street, if you will, and allowing companies to employ people here in Minnesota. And I just also recall that the sheet metal workers, local union number 480 in Faribault, also testified in support of this bill. So this is a bill that the union does support as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Woodard. Representative Gruenhagen renews his motion that Senate File 1236 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. The chair notes that a roll call has been requested, and the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Szymanski.
Aye.
Representative Mazerall.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Cornish.
Yes.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Kreisel. Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lesch.
No.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Shoemaker.
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
No.
Representative Swazinski?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative Wardlow?
Yes.
The vote is 9 aye, 6 nay. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative
Thank you,
Woodard.
Mr. Chair and Committee.
All right, the next bill on our agenda this morning is House File 292 with Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill? And at this point, the chair's intent is to hear testimony on the bill today and then lay it over for future consideration. So,
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move House File 292. And then I do have a DE amendment, so should I move the amendment?
Okay. Move Representative Anderson, would you like to move your amendment?
I would like to move the DE7 amendment to House File 292. It's a delete all amendment.
All right. All right, Representative Anderson.
Do you need me to explain the changes in the amendment?
First, is there any discussion on the DE7 amendment? Okay. Representative Anderson, would you explain the DE7 amendment for the committee?
The original language in the statute is for parenting plans to be voluntary and then the courts to have the option to do parenting plans. And due to the fiscal note that we received, we're trying to make it clear that the courts will not have to spend a lot of time in developing parenting plans. And so we've made some changes to that effect of making it so that the court won't have to be doing things. So basically in subdivision 2 is where it talks about the elements of the parenting plan. So if you want to know what a parenting plan is, that's still the same. And then in section 2, we made some changes where if the parents aren't, so in subdivision 3, number 2, if the parents are unable to agree to the terms of a parenting plan, the court is going to require the parents to participate in mediation in order to develop a parenting plan. And then the courts may waive the mediation requirement if neither parent can afford the mediation. So that's a change in the.
All right. Representative Anderson, we have a question from Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson, looking at your delete all amendment, lines 1.25 at set going forward, my reading, and tell me if I'm correct or not, my reading is that in spite of, or despite of, or in the face of any parenting plan the parents come forward with, if the court makes detailed findings while the proposed plan is not in the best interest of the child, the court does not have to adopt that plan. Am I correct?
Representative Anderson.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that is correct.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Smith.
So then in plain English, the judge is still the firewall here on the merits of any parenting plan.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Smith, that's correct.
Thank you.
All right.
So then in the rest of subdivision 2, it has the exceptions to when the parenting plan will not be mandatory. So items B, C, D, and E are when a parenting plan will not be required. And section D is where chapter 257 is, we will not be requiring parenting plans for paternity cases. And then we had subdivision 4 is basically the same. And we did delete section 5 as a repealer. We deleted subdivision 5 where it gave the courts the option of creating their own parenting plan. And then in section 6, we are putting the effective date out to August 1st, 2013, in trying to address the fiscal note. So, Mr. Chairman, we do have a fiscal note on this bill that we have submitted this new amended version, and so we have requested a new fiscal note on the bill and are very hopeful that our fiscal note will get reduced with the new version of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Is there any discussion to the DE7 amendment? Hearing none, we will take the vote on the adoption of the DE7 amendment into the bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, please proceed with your bill.
Okay, so parenting plans are not a new concept. They've been around for a long time. And in the 1990s, the federal government put together a task force called the U.S. Commission on Child and Family Welfare. And in 1996 is when they submitted this study called Parenting Our Children in the Best Interest of the Nation, and it was dated September of 1996. Their recommendation in this booklet, recommendation number 7, recommends that courts should require separating, divorcing, and unmarried parents living apart to attempt to develop parenting plans that set forth parental decision-making, parenting time, and residential arrangements for their children. The commission believes that a parenting plan is the best blueprint for parents' future ties to their children because it reflects the personal choices of the two people in charge of raising their children. And then in the state of Minnesota, we had a Minnesota Supreme Court task force that studied this issue. It was called the Supreme Court Parental Cooperation Task Force, and it was a two-year task force, and their report was dated January 14th in the year 2000, and our current statute that we have in Minnesota law was passed in the legislative session of 2000, and right now we currently have voluntary parenting plans. So there are a lot of benefits to having a parenting plan instead of using the current court process. By using a parenting plan, the divorce will be less adversarial and there'll be less conflict for the children. It will be should provide the divorce at a lower cost. It should be less time to complete the divorce. There should be better outcomes for the parents by doing a parenting plan. There should be better compliance with the terms of the divorce arrangement in the parenting plan because the parents are making agreements, and it's going to be a better way to resolve their future conflicts. So a parenting plan is a different concept than what we do right now in our divorce court system. A parenting plan is a term used to refer to a detailed divorce decree that two people with children can use as part of their divorce settlement. A parenting plan is a written description of each of the parents' responsibilities regarding parenting decision-making, parenting time, and residential arrangements. A parenting plan is more specific than a court order. It is developed by parents in consultation with each other and is intended to minimize ambiguity. The intention of the parenting plan is to shift the focus from parenting rights to parenting responsibilities. And a parenting plan is the best way to reflect both parents' personal choices for future parenting responsibilities of their children. Mr. Chairman, Mike McGinn was not able to be here today due to, or
what did I say?
Michael McGinn. Michael McNabb is not able to be here today, so he will not be able to be testifying this morning. And I have two more testifiers with me this morning. We have former Representative Andy Dawkins, who worked on this parenting plan legislation.
All right. Good morning, Mr.
Good
Dawkins.
Morning.
Please introduce yourself.
Andrew Dawkins, private practice attorney. I was a former legislator, and I'm going to skip. I testified last year in this bill, so I'll skip how much I miss all of you and enjoy being back, and the accolades that I wanted to that I did in fact hand out at the last time I testified for the changes in family law that have been enacted over the past years. As I practice family law, it's pretty universal these days that people think the parenting plans law, the current voluntary parenting plans law, was a huge success at getting more parents to cooperate, getting more agreements ahead of time to bring to the court, as opposed to litigating the custody. And the key part of it is that you don't have to have a primary parent win a custody label. Now you just simply have to figure out how do you divide up the parenting time. In some cases it makes sense that it's 40-60, in some cases 25-75, some cases 50-50, and the parents just figure out a schedule. Here's our residential schedule. Nobody wins custody. Same thing with due decision making, and same thing with putting in a dispute resolution mechanism for when you can't agree. That's the current state of the law, and I think most people agree that that was a good change that the legislature did. We did this in a bipartisan fashion. My Senate author was Senator Kiskaden from Rochester, a Republican, in the House. We did it with male and female support. Representative Hausman, who currently is my state rep now that I'm retired, she was a strong supporter all the way through that you try to get parents to both be part of bringing the kids up and not having a winner-take-all kind of thing. The simplicity of this bill and the beauty of this bill really can be captured just this simply. We now will say that in those cases where the parents haven't come up with a parenting plan themselves, the judge can put a parenting plan in place and not do the labels. A judge doesn't have to make this be a litigation where two sides, two parents, are fighting over the children and having a winner-take-all mentality operate to paint as bleak and terrible a picture about the other parent as they possibly can. It will eliminate more of those cases and will get us more to where judges are simply deciding how much parenting time does parent A get, how much parenting time does parent B get. And it's not going, I'm going to get to the fiscal note because I think that's really the most important thing about what we need to talk about today. But it's really just that simple as to what this bill does. It's important to know the context of why we can do this today and why we can have all future divorces not have a winner-take-all, someone wins sole physical custody when you litigate. And the reason is because we made changes over the past years that the child support law is no longer hinged on who is the primary physical custodial parent. The child support law is hinged on which parent has how much time. Any parent that has less than 45% of the time with the child, but over 10% gets a 12% reduction in child support. If you got a parent that has, both parents have between 46 and 54%, then you presume that there's equal parenting time. And so we don't need to have physical custody labels for child support anymore. In addition, the legislature changed the law about moving out of state. It used to be that the primary physical custodial parent had a leg up in deciding when they wanted to relocate to a different state with the child. We no longer have that. It's now simply the best interest of the child. So again, you don't need the labels anymore. And in fact, many judges refuse to use the labels right now without even this law being passed. But still, there's a whole lot of judges that do, and this will change that. Now, the fiscal note. The real problem that I see with this fiscal note is that it's assuming that there's going to be a ton of more work for judges to do, because when parents voluntarily do a parenting plan, you can see them come 30 pages long, which cover every detail down to what hour of the day you split the Christmas and Eve and the Christmas morning and all those kinds of things that you do want to have in a parenting plan if you got two parents that are trying to figure out their business relationship with each other down the road. But when a judge has to do one because the parents haven't come up with one, it can be three sentences. It can be first sentence. The residential schedule is every other weekend plus every Wednesday night with parent A, and parent B gets the rest of the time. That's all. Right? Or the judge could be more creative and do two sentences if the judge wanted to. Second thing the judge does is say, okay, here's how we're going to do the decision-making. Right now, it's almost always, in most cases, presumed by our law that there be joint legal custody. And the judge says, here's the stuff in the statute you got to know about making joint legal custody decisions. You got to talk about the religious upbringing, you got to talk about schooling, you got to talk about the medical care. And the judge is done with that part of the parenting plan. Then the judge says, okay, and if you come to an impasse in the future, you're going to go to a mediator and you're trying to figure it out before you come back to court to do it. Done. Parenting plan's that simple. Now, if you look at the fiscal note, and I do think, by the way, in the way the bill's drafted, if we're not having it voted out today, we need to pay attention to know the difference. I think the clearest distinction is a parenting plan is what two parents come together on and bring to the court. A parenting order is that part that the judge does. And then we got to make it clear that the parenting order part doesn't have to be the 30-page long detail after detail, but simply the three sentences that I just talked about. Now, if you look at the fiscal note and you look at those assumptions, the assumption is that there will be 2 hours to hold hearings and prepare parenting plans in 3,400 pro se and non-consensual cases. And that gets you to the cost of what they quoted, I think, is $2.7 million in a year for having enough judge units to do all these new cases. All these new cases? What's going on in these cases right now? These cases are being litigated. Judges are having to do all the best interest findings to say, here are the 13 factors to decide. And they get this long with what they're doing. That's what they're doing right now. So this is going to not increase the... I mean, if somebody can tell me who, I wish that Mary Liz Holberg was here, I wish that Janet Marshall was here, I wish that the Judy Rehock, who prepared this fiscal note, was here, to listen to this. I mean, I'm really open to trying to figure it out. All right, but Mr. what do they Dawkins? Think happens with these 3,400 cases now? Thank you very much.
All right. We just wanted to remind you, we will be getting a new fiscal note probably within the next 2 weeks. So, Representative Anderson, you have another testifier?
Marilyn McKnight is
okay.
here.
Erickson. All right. Ms. McKnight, would you introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'm Marilyn McKnight. I am owner of Erickson Mediation Institute, having been in mediation practice since 77, having actually brought mediation, family mediation, to the state of Minnesota, and third practice in the country. I've remained very active in the area of family mediation in the state and nationally and actually internationally. So my work is, we were doing parenting plans starting in about 1982 in mediated divorces, and we're very, very happy when we finally got the legislation. We were instrumental in training people in the state of Tennessee in mediators for many, many years, and that state in 98 started a pilot program on parenting plans, and what they learned was that parenting plans worked so well that the returns to court after the divorce were drastically reduced. The cases that I get post-decree, most of them are parenting disputes, and the clients are very, very surprised to see a parenting plan and saying things like, well, why didn't we do that in the first place? We wouldn't even be here right now. Parenting plans probably have reduced court time to a great extent in the state of Minnesota, but I don't think there are statistics on that. In the country, 34 states have parenting plan laws. 24 of those states, they're mandatory. parenting plans are living, breathing documents, we always say to our clients. There's actually a paragraph in our parenting plans that say, you know, if the two of you have a disagreement about something in the plan, or you want to change the way you originally agreed to it, you can write that up. The two of you can, if you agree, sign and date that, and you don't have to necessarily go back and amend your decree. You can keep that, and or you can return to mediation if you're in conflict about it. But it doesn't create many returns to court that I know of. Very, very few of the cases that we've mediated parenting plans in ever come back. the other thing that I want to say is that the payment for mediation services, mediators actually will negotiate fees for low-income people. I will mediate for $20 an hour as opposed to my regular hourly fee, because we believe, and I think a lot of lawyers do this too, that if you get someone in, it's not going to make up 50 or 80% of your caseload. It's going to be a very, very small percentage. It's a good thing to do, and it's the right thing to do. So that's what we mediators do. I just wanted to say that with those statistics that I mentioned, nine of the states where it's not mandatory have the statutes, and 10 of them, in 10 of those where it's not mandatory, they actually have wording that say they allow the court to order parenting plans. So even where they're not mandatory, there's a lot more parenting plans going on. Most of my colleagues around the country who mediate divorces mediate parenting plans routinely, and I think it's good for Minnesota to finally make them mandatory. I think we're helping families, and that's what we're here to do.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McKnight. Mm-hmm. We have another testifier, Ms. Hugdahl. Is that correct? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. Speak toward the microphone, if you would. And
just scooch over. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services Advocacy Project. Representative Anderson and I have been having conversations for quite some time about this bill, and I appreciate her willingness to talk with me about it and talk about concerns. I've been talking with Mr. Dawkins and other proponents as well. The concern I have with the bill, I'm going to back up a step so that kind of lays the context of it, but essentially I think, as you've heard before, that the point of the bill is to lay out, everybody winds up with a court order in the end. There may be two paths of how you get there. One may be through a parenting plan route, and there are other folks who are exempted out of the parenting plan route in the bill who will come to court much as they do now and have a court order in the end. There are some pieces in the bill that apply more to the parenting plan path, and so we've tried to kind of have everybody wind up in the same place, but there are some small differences between how you get there. So that we all agree on. The language that I think is a little bit confusing, and we're going to continue talking about it, is in page 1, lines 17 and 18. And what that says is a parenting plan shall be used in lieu of an order for child custody and parenting time. Our concern is that it tends to try to re-blend those streams together, and we're not sure it's entirely clear on what it suggests, especially down below in 1.25, where, as Representative Smith pointed out, the court still has the authority to approve those parenting plans. So in lieu of is, we think, really confusing language, and we want to make sure that if we've made distinctions between those two paths, we keep those clear so that people who aren't in the parenting plan path, trying to say that five times, come in to court. They come out of court with an order that they understand what it means, they understand what the arrangement is, and they can go forward and it's enforceable. So thank you, members of the committee, and I look forward to working with Representative Anderson as the bill, as I understand, is going to lay over for a little while.
That is right. Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Representative Liebling, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my questions are more for the proponents. I have a couple of things that I'm wondering about. One is on line 1.21, where it says the court may waive the mediation requirement if neither parent can afford mediation. And I'm wondering there what would happen in the situation where one of the parents can't afford it. So that's my first question. And then the second thing that it gives me pause looking at this is on line 2.29, where you've stricken the word alleged from current law and put in found by the court to have committed domestic abuse. And this is under the section restrictions on preparation of parenting plan. So currently, apparently, this is you're not required to use dispute resolution. Dispute resolution processes other than the judicial process may not be required in the preparation of a parenting plan if a parent is alleged to have committed domestic abuse. Now you're changing that to if a parent is found by the court. So that gives me concern that there has to be some kind of prior litigation. Otherwise, you're going to require the parenting plan. And, you know, there might be situations where you've got a family with a lot of conflict where there just hasn't been a judicial proceeding to prove it. So those are my two concerns.
All right. Mr. Dawkins, I'm remiss in not welcoming you back to the legislature here.
No problem.
Please proceed with your response to Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, for the first question about if neither can afford mediation, oftentimes it's the case that the judge or the judicial officer that's working with the family early on says, well, you know, one of you can afford to pay 90% of the cost, the other one can pay 10%, let's try and get it done. And sometimes you get one parent says, I'm doing the whole thing because I want to try and get there and get it done. So I think that's what's intended there if it isn't clear. And so if you got two that can't afford it as opposed to if just one can't afford, then maybe the other can afford to pay the full freight. Your question on page 2 as to alleged versus found by the court, I think, is a significant difference. It's not really part of what needs to happen with this legislation. I do believe that most folks that mediate and do parenting plans will tell you that once you've resolved the conflict with a parenting plan, it eliminates the future, or not totally eliminates, but reduces the future likelihood of there being domestic violence. So it's usually good if you can get someone, and you can do it, and sometimes you have different rooms and do shuttle diplomacy to try and get it done. I think it's probably a good change to make, but you're right to note that as that's a significant difference, because it will mean that instead of you just writing up an allegation that, you know, she followed me around everywhere, and she sat too close to me at so-and-so, and you'd write it up like that, and then you can say, now I don't have to go to mediation, that it'll have to be that the court actually finds that there's been harassment or domestic violence or something.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Dawkins, I mean, I think that's a real problem. That could be a really big problem for some families. Maybe Ms. Hugdahl would like to comment on that, but... you know, as far as the first part of this, I think it's, you know, maybe this isn't what's intended, but I think the language is very troublesome. the court shall require the parents to participate in mediation unless neither of them can afford it. And it's great if one parent will cover the cost and the other doesn't have to. I mean, if people can agree to that extent already, great. Maybe they don't even need the mediation. If, you know, but these are people that, you know, apparently need mediation, so they're not getting along so well. I don't know. I would like to change that to either.
So,
that it can be waived. This is allowing it to be waived. This is just something that says, you know, the court has to require this unless, you know, this is just setting out when the court can waive it. So I think that we should be giving the court some more latitude here.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Liebling, if you read on line 2.1, the section B, if the court finds that a parent has committed domestic abuse, they're going to be waived from doing the parenting plan, so they would not have the mediation requirement, because the 1A only applies to people that are doing parenting plans. Only the people that are doing parenting plans will be sent to a mediator to work on a parenting plan. People with domestic abuse situations will be in the court system, and they will not be doing parenting plans, so they will not be ordered into mediation because they're not even going to be doing parenting plans. So I don't know if we need to clarify something that 1A is for doing parenting plans, and then all of the exceptions for people that will not be doing parenting plans are B, C, D, and E, and all of those people that are all the exceptions to the mandatory parenting plan. And so people that with domestic abuse will not be doing parenting plans, so therefore they will not get ordered into mediation.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, I don't have a good enough grasp of this legislation to totally follow that, but it looks to me, though, like, again, up on 2.2, that the court has to find domestic abuse for a parenting plan to be not required. So, again, I think we're taking people who, you know, may be very afraid of a spouse and making, unless there's a court finding, they're going to be required to go through this procedure. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but maybe Ms. Hugdahl could help me with this.
Ms. Hugdahl?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I'm just looking this as we're talking, so that's usually a somewhat dangerous plan. But as I read the top of page 2, the language that talks about it, when you look at the language is being struck from current law. Current law reads that if the parents don't agree, the court can do one on its own motion, except that it can't do so if it finds that a parent has committed domestic abuse against a parent. I think that current law has that piece in there. The piece that's being added on is the mediation piece as well. The existing law does talk about a finding, but it's in terms of the court doing a plan on its own motion. And this is coupling that now with a mediation piece of it. And so I think that's the distinction between the two, and that's maybe...
I believe now, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Dawkins,
that indeed when I was doing the parenting plan, Chief Austin, that Ms. Hugdahl has exactly right. So we'll have to work on it to make sure it's consistent, and you check on this again later, but I think we can prove to you that it is a consistency as opposed to a new change.
All right, any further discussion? All right, we'll move on to further testimony. Mr. Michael Harrison.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Michael Harrison. I am the Executive Director of Judicial Common Sense, a group I started 5 years ago with two retired attorneys concerned basically with the judicial system in the state. Up to the Delete All Amendment, we had several concerns, but that had taken care of quite a few of our concerns. The only concern that we have left, and this will go back to the discussion, is that we are concerned about detailed findings. I get many people coming to me almost every day with their divorce decrees, and specifically with the 13 factors of the best interest of the children, where it states in the current statute that the court is to make detailed findings. we don't find detailed findings. We just see the court says we found this. Detailed finding to me would specify maybe on such and such date this happened, or, you know, somebody saw dad call mom and a bad name, and then we call this abuse. But we don't see that. And our concern is, and I want to go back to Representative Smith's concern about the judge having the power to ictionary this whole thing by saying, well, I found domestic abuse. And so we would like to see somewhere, and maybe our idea is a little more stringent than it should be, but I'd like to see that there's clear and convincing evidence that domestic abuse has occurred. Because, like I said, I get numerous people, and last Tuesday's hearing was no exception. You had a handful of testifiers concerned that the court had made findings against them when there was really no findings. So I would ask that you would consider that in your bill, and thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Do we also have a Cindy Cunningham who would like to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Cindy Cunningham. I am from St. Paul. I am speaking in support of some of the changes to House File 292, but not all as they relate to House File 322. I have been in the family court system dealing with custody issues involving our three children for the past 9 years. My parental belief is that children need and deserve relationships with both parents. Both parents are a part of who they are as a person. You cannot take a child and say this part is the father and this part is the mother. They are intertwined. For a child to grow up whole, they need to resolve and integrate all aspects of who they are as a person. They are the ones who need the focus and support when parents are in the process of establishing two households. The system isn't as broken as the families who come through their doors by the sheer virtue of the reason that they are in the custody dispute. Regarding House File 292, mandating parenting plans and mediation is a positive approach that I support. It ensures a system whereby parents have to work together and attempt to focus on children, not just themselves. During the development of a parenting plan, there would and should be professionals who can guide parents through this painful time of dividing their lives and families. These changes attempt to support families when establishing two households for children and are a vehicle to guarantee that both parents are involved in the children's lives. However, in sub 4, as it relates to the custody designation, which is related to House File 322, to me that is in total contradiction. I have this in one testimony. I'm trying to split it, so bear with me a little bit. That final designation of the 50-50 custody, which is House File 322, totally nullifies and I think puts barriers up against parents actually working together. There is no reason, there's no motivation to focus on children, nor to come up with this joint parenting plan if either one of the parents believes or knows that it doesn't matter, they will still get what they want because that's what the law dictates. I have my additional notes. In listening to people, I can say that in 9 years I have seen three mediators, three guardian ad litems, and at least two parenting experts, all of which I have paid for. No one has offered nor, and I'll get upset here, but no one has offered nor granted, when asked, any reduction in any of these fees. All of these systems fell apart because the children's father refused to pay. The court system, under my experience, has functioned as you're describing it. That's what scares me. The courts have, and I, have tried to assist my children in having a relationship with their father, but they are the ones that have suffered at this point. Parenting plans have no meat behind them. We can talk about whether if the parenting plan isn't followed, where's the resolution? My only resolution, there's no guts to it. There's no consequence. When the parenting plan isn't followed, it becomes just the argument between the parents. I can go back to court, but then we're looking at time, effort, money, and really what the outcome is. And so all of those agreements are set up for people who agree to agree. And that's typically not why people are getting divorced. They've already proven that they're not making good decisions or moving forward with their lives. As far as domestic abuse law, current law says you don't need to do a parenting plan. I can tell you I was totally ordered and supported, pushed, whatever, that I came up with a parenting plan with my ex. It has not been followed. I don't have the money or the time to go back to court to hold it accountable.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. All right. Representative Lesh has a question.
It's not for Ms. Cunningham, but Ms. Cunningham's testimony made me think of a question I had had based on previous testimony. So it's for the author, Ms. Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, do you have a list of, and I was thinking about my situation, my ex and I split everything 50-50, and little did I realize at the time, and I think even the lawyers didn't realize, that you can't really do that. For as one example, tax law, federal tax law, doesn't allow you to do things 50-50. I mean, you can swap deduction either year, but you can't, for example, go halvesies on the child care deduction amount that you use, whether it's through your company or whether it's through deducting on your taxes directly, because as far as the feds are, as far as the IRS are concerned, if you have your child 50.00001% of the time, you're the person. Do you have a list of those kinds of problems that we can't do anything about because it's just federal tax law, other federal law, other state law that makes it more difficult to truly fairly implement something like this?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, this is not the joint physical custody bill. We don't address any time issues in the parenting plan. There's no mandatory 50-50 time in a parenting plan.
Well, Representative Lesh. Representative Anderson.
A lot of these parenting plans are done in mediation, and Marilyn could talk to you a little bit about how, you know, when you do them with a professional mediator, they know a lot of these things. They have a lot of tax experts. They bring people into the mediation room that are tax experts and use different things like that. The professionals that do these things do have access to a lot of that information.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in a parenting plan, the amount of parenting time is not the only thing that you're deciding in that. And so that's the reason I asked it with respect to your bill, because it goes to a lot of other decisions that couples who are splitting up are making, obviously time being, you know, sort of the elephant in the room, but there are many other factors here. So that's why I asked the question. If I'd like to know if there's an outstanding list like this and if it fluctuates.
Representative Anderson.
Marilyn McKnight, speak to this.
All right. Ms. McKnight?
Are you asking for a list of all of the factors that we put into a parenting plan? I mean, we certainly discuss, and when we do the full divorce, get into the filing status, the exemptions, all of that. And most parents try to make those fair. Your exemptions are certainly negotiable. Filing status isn't. You have to have 51% of the overnights with a child under your roof in a year. But all of those are discussed. And sometimes when one parent may have, maybe there's just one child, and one parent may have that child one extra overnight during the year, they might say, well, then the other parent can have the exemption.
Maybe I can
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I can help you by rephrasing the question. Is there a list of either federal laws or other state laws which prevent parents from creating an equitable I'm going to say division, but if you wanted to share everything about your child 50-50 in a parenting plan, is there a list of other state or federal laws that make that problematic somewhere?
I know of nothing of that sort.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman, can I make
Representative Anderson?
Just to make it clear, on subdivision 2 is the elements of a parenting plan. So it's very similar to a court order and what's being done now, and that just designates one of the biggest differences is they're going to designate decision-making responsibilities. But the other thing that I think you might be getting at too is parents in a parenting plan can create their own agreements. They can agree to the deductions and that type of thing that maybe isn't normally done right now. But the mediators that help them develop these parenting plans are are professionals and have worked on these things for a long time.
Okay. And just by way of final comment, Mr. Chair, and I understand and I appreciate that, and I know this area is confusing, but no matter what parents agree to, for example, if you agree on equal deductibility for, say, child care deduction, for example, that doesn't matter under the IRS. You can agree to that all day long, and you put your child's Social Security number in when you file. If someone's already claimed that, for example, if your ex filed before you, you're out of luck. It just doesn't matter under federal law. So that's what I was getting at. I think it's a quagmire, this area of law, when someone is making a decision. So I just think it would be worthwhile to have that list. But that's all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to change topics from that one, and I have another question about the DE amendment. And it's on line 2.23 to 2.25, where it says if the parenting plan does not designate legal and physical custody and such a designation is necessary for enforcement of the plan for any purpose, it shall be deemed that the parents have joint legal and physical custody. You know, let me just say, Representative Anderson, I appreciate that you're willing to tackle this subject. You know, I'm no expert in this area, but I do know that you know, this goes brings us into this joint physical custody debate, and I don't know, first of all, whether child support is at all a topic in your parenting plan or whether that's entirely separate, but I do know that the amount of time, as has been said, impacts what people pay in child support. So I'm wondering if we're bringing this in like this, if it's not mentioned, you know, suddenly without anybody discussing it, we're impacting the way the child support allocation is going to work. Am I missing something there? I don't know who wants to answer that.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling. What Andy Dawkins said, that when we changed to an income shares model, it's no longer designated that you have to be the sole custodian.
Right.
So you don't need that label. What this is getting at is parenting plans. There's a lot of groups, a lot of people that want to try and get rid of the labels of joint physical custody, those labels. And so what they do in mediation, Maryland can address, is a lot of the time they will do a parenting plan without the labels. And so if they do a parenting plan without the labels, they are going to be considered to have joint legal and joint physical custody. And this was an issue that I worked with Melinda on, and I think we have resolution with an agreement on this is the appropriate language to make it the strongest right. language.
Ms. Hogdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I did work with Representative Anderson on this piece. It originally said a parenting plan or order. And remember when I talked about those two tracks? This is when we talked about the people who are doing the parenting plans typically have some kind of assistance to help them understand what they're doing. So if they want to use alternate terms and not use them in the order to reach resolution, they tend to understand what they have. By deleting our order, we wanted to keep the people in the other track who don't have the parenting plan path. We wanted to have them still come out of court with an order they understood what it was. It's because the courts can also do a parenting plan. We wanted to have that little bit of a division, even though everybody winds up in the same place. So for those parents who do the parenting plan, they can use those alternate labels if it helps them resolve those issues. And I believe probably their child support would still be determined under whatever that percentage is as part of their parenting plan that they submitted.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Dawkins can kind of tell you what happened with this bill originally.
All right. I would like to remind the committee that we will be laying this bill over, and we will be having further discussion on it. We do have other visitors at our committee this morning that have come a distance that want to discuss the next bill. Please be brief.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling. When I passed the parenting plan, when the legislature passed the parenting plans law back then, there was concern that what if you're in Europe or whether if you're in Ohio and someone's wanting to enforce an order and they say, hey, we got to look for words and say who's got the custody. So we had to stick the language in back then to kind of appease everybody. But what you need is the parenting time. If somebody has parenting time, the other person's taking the kid, that's the kidnapping thing. You don't have to worry about whether you got the labels on it or not. That's one thing. And secondly, that this makes it simpler than the way we did it before. It just says you got joint physical. So and that's the words that they need in Europe and the words they need in Ohio. But for child support purposes, the magic words are obligor and obligee, and we don't change that. So for all the Department of Human Services concerns and so on, as long as the parenting plan still has someone as an obligor and someone as an obligee, you're okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't realize that we were just going to lay this over, so I won't belabor it. But that doesn't exactly answer my question. Doesn't putting that in, joint physical custody, doesn't that bring with it something about how much each parent pays? I'm just worried about that getting slid in there without anybody, you know. I get what you're saying about not needing a label, but that if that's in there, doesn't that impact your support?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Dawkins.
Representative Liebling, I'd rather slide this whole thing out and not have it. I didn't like it when we stuck it in back then even. So I think you're right. It raises more red herrings than it solves problems. But until, I guess, we convince the rest of the world that somewhere, someplace in Ohio or Europe, somebody's going to want to know who's got custody, we'll probably need to have this language. But I don't think we need it.
All right. Representative Anderson, have any further comments before we wrap this one up and move on to the next bill?
Well, thank you for the committee's time today, and we'll be laying this bill over today, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Next on our agenda, we have House File 322 with Representative Peggy Scott presenting the bill. Would someone like to move the bill before the committee? Representative Swedzinski?
So moved.
All right. The bill is before us. Again, I would remind the committee that we will not be voting on this bill today. We will be laying it over. Welcome, Representative Scott. Please introduce your bill for us.
Thank you, Chair Szymanski. First of all, is there an amendment in your packets to change the effective dates?
All right.
Since this bill was introduced last year, there should be an amendment there changing the effective dates. And then, so I'd like, right. Could somebody?
Yes. Representative Swedzinski moves is it the A5 amendment, Representative Scott?
I actually don't have a copy.
Okay, I believe that we have an A5 amendment that amends the implementation dates. Representative Swedzinski moves the amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have one more oral amendment that House Research informed me of when I got here. There was one date that she missed, and it's on line 16.25, and so we would just need an oral amendment to include it, and that date would be changed to 1 year from the date that's in the bill, so that would be changed to July 1st of 2014.
Okay. Ms. Perius, would you like to reread the oral amendment to the committee?
Mr. Chair and members, this is to House File 322, the first engrossment. On page 16, line 25, delete 2013 and insert 2014.
Okay. Any discussion to that amendment? Hearing none, we'll vote. All in favor of that oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I'll keep my comments fairly brief this morning. As most of you know, this issue of joint physical custody or equal shared parenting is not a new it's not a new issue. It's been around for several years. What is new is our bill and our version of joint physical custody and equal shared parenting. It is by far the most comprehensive of any bill that has ever been offered in our state and quite possibly in the nation. We have raised the standard on many levels, placing more assurances for child safety, reducing conflict by making the process less subjective, sort of the what was already talked about, he said, she said, winner take all, who's the best parent contest scenario. This bill places the best interests of the child in front of the best interest of the adults, which are the parents and the lawyers in the situation. There is a bipartisan support on this issue. We have around 20 authors here in the House bipartisanly, and same with the Senate. I think we can all agree that the best interest of the child is to have equal access to both parents. The bill uses children in need of protection standards and also contains other standards that protect children and families, and it also makes exceptions for geographic distance. It's important to know that this bill allows parents to reach an arrangement that is best for them and their schedules, much as what was discussed with Representative Anderson's parenting plan. if 30% time is adequate for one parent and 70 for the other, and they both agree, then that's the agreement that's submitted to the courts. We will gladly answer questions regarding this bill, and we also want to discuss the possible savings to the courts, our state, and families if this bill is passed. We challenge the assumptions that were used in arriving at the fiscal note. We requested a fiscal note a year ago in January. We requested it three times, finally got one this January. And to me, that signals that the courts had a difficult time arriving at figuring what the fiscal note should be, and that by their own admission, actually. And before we move to testimony, I do want to address a video that was sent around with former Chief Justice Sandy Keith, who testified in that video in support of this bill. And some have asked if Judge Keith still supports this. He does, emphatically. Judge Keith is a person that likes to be fairly private, and he doesn't like to come out and kind of throw his weight around as a former Chief Justice. But he did, so he won't come and testify, but he did give me permission to give his phone number out and welcomes any phone calls from any of you. So I'm going to give that phone number. It's 507-288-9111. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Molly Olson with the Center for Parental Responsibility, who has been a citizen involved in this issue for quite some time.
Good morning, Ms. Olson. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief today. My name is Molly Olson. I live in Little Canada, Minnesota. I am here as a citizen concerned about children. I'm the founder of the Center for Parental Responsibility, where our project mission is to remove the obstacles that prevent both parents from being fully and equally involved in the lives of their children. It's an all-volunteer group. We have no paid staff. Neither myself or anyone has ever been paid anything to lobby on this issue. I have nothing to personally gain from this. I have no husband, no ex-husband, no family member, no close friend with an open and family court case where this would ever make a difference or matter. The only reason I do this is because it's the right thing for children based on volumes and 40 years of research. And I have been researching this for 13 years. This bill has been vetted at the legislature for two decades, actually, that I know of, and I have some records that indicate that it started before that. I personally have been doing this for 13 years, as I said. 13 years ago, our bill consisted of three words. Today, 13 years later, our bill is 13 pages. The bill grew over time because we received input from judges, lawyers, current legislators, past legislators, parents who've been through the system, Senate research, House research, bill language from other states and even other countries, legal research, social science research. We poured through the Minnesota statutes, and we were always open to hear the concerns of our opponents and working to address those issues in the bill that concern them when it could be done without infecting the integrity of our bill. We did all this to make sure we had the best possible bill for the children of Minnesota. This bill has been properly and thoroughly vetted, and as Peggy said, it is and always has been a nonpartisan bill with bipartisan support. The bill is long overdue. The most basic legal and child-centered question this bill needs to address is this: under what circumstances will the legislature allow courts to take a fit, loving parent away from a child? With that, I'm going to reserve any further comments for Thursday. Due to time, we have several testifiers that can only be here today, so I'm going to defer my time to them. First of all, we'd like to ask Ron Seeloff, attorney from Egan, to come up.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Mr. Seeloff, please take a chair at our testifiers' table and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, and members of the committee, I am here today to speak in favor of the passage of House File 322, creating a presumption of joint physical custody for children. I have been a family law practitioner for many, many years, and I formerly served in the House and, in fact, on this body many years ago when Marty Sabo was Speaker. and excuse me, I've been involved in the legislation relating to family law issues for many years. I served in the Senate for 10 years thereafter and on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I make those comments because I empathize with all of you who have to make all of these decisions with so many conflicting opinions, and somehow we all have to get it right. And in that connection, I want to say that I believe that this bill contributes in a very positive way to the gradual evolution of family law in Minnesota. Many years ago, in the early 80s, we adopted a presumption in favor of joint legal custody. And that law has endured all these years. It has worked very, very well. I personally have not ever heard anyone criticize that use of that presumption. If you look at the statute, though, what you'll see is that with the presumption of joint legal custody, the statute says that an award of joint legal custody shall not affect a child support award. And back then, custody, the finding of custody, was the linchpin for child support. Whoever got custody got support. And so the reason that was placed in there were there were concerns that by an award of joint legal custody that it would affect child support. And that is no longer so, which I'll mention in a few minutes, but my point I want to make that had the structure of the law then been the way it is today, perhaps we would have had a presumption of joint physical custody many, many years ago. One of the major changes in this evolution was the change in our child support guidelines. Some of you may recall that when the child support guidelines were first enacted in the 1980s, child support was based on the income only of the obligor. Essentially, except for lower income people, the non-custodial parent, who was always the obligor, you just say 25% of that person's net income, bang, that was the child support. You never consider the income of the custodial parent. Now, the reason for that was the underlying values and philosophy that we at the time had. The concept then was that there was a division of roles in the family, and that the custodial parent, the reason we didn't consider the custodial parent's income is because the presumption was is that the custodial parent was contributing in kind to the children. In other words, the custodial parent took care of the kids and devoted all of this time, energy, and resources, whereas the non-custodial parent contributed in the form of money. And so that's how the system worked. My bottom line point was that the old child support guidelines reflected underlying values and understandings of how families worked 40 years ago. Now that's been changed, as you all know. Now our child support guidelines are based on the combined incomes of both of the parties. There is no presumption in the child support law that one party is contributing all the care, empathy, in-kind contributions for the child. And so now, and so that kind of role concept is the underlying presumption has disappeared. There's been some other change, some language change. Some years ago, we changed the word, quote, visitation, close quote, to parenting time. And I'll just tell you a little anecdote. I had a young man in my office many years ago and who was just getting familiar with the vocabulary of the family law, and he ran into the word visitation. And he said to me, and this was entirely, you know, straightforward, he said, you know, I thought visitation occurred when you were meeting somebody who was dead. You see? Now, there's an implication there about how maybe he thought the family law was treating him as a as meeting with a dead person. In other words, that he no longer had this meaningful role. But even these subtle language changes show cultural changes. Now, the most important thing that has happened in recent years has been the decoupling of the finding of child of custody of child support. This was an excellent bill. I don't know who did it, but it happened. And what it did is that under the old family law, we had a system of a top-down logical approach, which law typically does. You made the finding of custody, and from the finding of custody follows all of the consequences. And so whoever got custody got the child support. What the new law does is that decouples the finding of custody, whether physical or legal, from an award of child support. It doesn't matter who has custody. What determines child support in Minnesota is the parenting time. And the advantage to that is that rather than having this enormous titanic struggle over who has custody, now the struggles tend to be on these various percentages. It'll be, well, are you going to have a week for Christmas or a day for Christmas, or how are you going to do the math? In terms of when you get into the judicial system, it's much easier to work on a logical parenting schedule than it is for this custody. And so I can't emphasize that
Mr. Kumatla, we have several other testifiers. I don't mean to rush you, but...
Okay. I will conclude. So what I want to say is that it is logical and reasonable to create a presumption of joint physical custody. After all, there are two parents. The children need parents. And if you look at it objectively, it is really an odd view that you should not have a presumption of joint physical custody. People's expectations have changed in 30 or 40 years, and I want to say that in this case, I believe that this law, rather than the law leading the people, actually the common expectation of people now is actually leading the law. This is long overdue. I'm going to make about three or four very short points. First, I believe that the addressing of the issue of the domestic abuse the way it is done in the bill is a very good provision. What has happened in Minnesota, because people, the recession and a variety of other things, people can't even afford to pay the filing fees for a divorce. Right. Domestic abuse petitions have become a divorce substitute. It doesn't cost anything. But the domestic abuse law actually encourages people to make false allegations of domestic abuse to get into the system.
Mr. Seeloff, if I can interrupt you, Representative Cornish has a comment.
Representative Scott, I just wanted to let you know that I have to take off. Somebody showed up in my office, but I wanted to voice my support for your bill, and I look forward to seeing it again. I think it's a good bill and a great job you're doing. Thank you.
Two more points.
All right.
They will be brief.
30 seconds, Mr. Seeloff. Okay.
Only about 15% of the people that get into these custody disputes have these emotional problems. By not enacting this bill, you're allowing the tail to wag the dog. The 85% of the people who are can work these things out. And then finally, I want to say that as a lawyer, when you meet people in dissolution proceedings and custody battles, you do not see people in their finest hour. Okay. We had some very excellent testimony from a psychologist about a year ago who said, you know, all these issues after a year or two, they do kind of tone down and things do work. And so that is true. And so I would simply encourage the court, or I'm sorry, different form, I would encourage this committee to pass this bill. It's a very positive bill, which is consistent with a long history of improvements in our law. Thank you.
All right. And again, Mr. Seeloff, as a former member of the House, welcome back to our chamber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Representative Scott, do you have another testifier?
Mary Hansen, I believe, is next.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. And again, I would ask you to be as brief as possible so that more folks can get up to testify this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our committee time will end at 10 a.m., so...
I'm Mary Hansen of rural Biola, Wisconsin. I'm a mother of three children. I have two living in the Twin Cities. I hold a bachelor's degree in psychology from UC Santa Cruz. I'm a grandmother and a lifelong feminist. I've raised my two sons to be feminists. Both are feminist fathers now. Lately, though, I've been feeling some kind of shame that my feminism has not helped make laws that have ended up harming the very kind of father that we'd hoped would evolve. I can't sleep at night thinking about how sad and helpless my son feels being kept away from his son most of the time. I worry that a false or exaggerated claim of abuse will send him to jail, knowing that current laws partially stem from anger we felt and still feel about the historic unfair treatment of women. My son's truncated time with his son means my husband and I have not been able to bond well with the little guy. He looks at us like we're complete strangers, and you don't know how much that hurts. I'm now bonded with my other son, new baby, so I know the joy that I've been missing out on, and I feel robbed. My first grandson is also being robbed, though, of the chance to create happy memories with his cousins, aunts, and uncles, as half of his extended family. Given the chance, they would be part of his identity and provide emotional and financial support for his entire life, but that's not happening now. My grandson's mother gives my grandson loving care, and I honor that. But I fear that without my son's fathering, my grandson will not grow into a mature, self-disciplined man. It was my husband, not me, who installed in my son the gumption to overcome his ADD, go to college, earn advanced degrees, and rise to the top of his career field. My husband taught him skills I don't have. He knew how to deal with playground bullies, and I sure didn't. Though I gave my son my ideals, it was only my husband who was able to model for my son respect for women. I'm concerned about the future of feminism if unfair laws aren't revised. Unfair laws, one-sided laws, lead to resentment and a possible backlash against women. Historically, and in many countries today, women have to fear that their husbands can take away their children because children are men's property. As it stands, children in Minnesota are close to being women's property. If we women want equality for ourselves, we must grant equality to men. This new generation of fathers is just learning an expanded role in their children's lives. And to learn that, they need time with their kids, more time than they're being granted now. Keep in mind that women aren't born knowing how to be mothers either. Men won't do exactly the same as mothers, so that might bother us sometimes. But for the kids, those differences are a good thing. We, as feminists, absolutely need to support the men that we older feminists have raised up right. Please don't undermine that upbringing with laws that treat all single fathers like potential criminals. For feminism to come to fruition and survive, we need to make a society fair to both genders. My hero Martin Luther King said, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." So, I'm asking for all the sad paternal grandmothers, and paternal grandfathers, please vote for House File 322. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hanson. All right. Our next testifier, Ms. Representative Scott.
Michelle McDonald.
All right. Ms. McDonald, please take a seat at the table. Introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm Michelle Lowney McDonald. I've been practicing family law for over 25 years. I've been an adjunct family court referee for most of that time and a small claims court judge still. I'm also a mother and a stepmother of four. After litigating hundreds of custody cases, I met Benedictus Ambuna, whose tragic custody case inspired me to pray to Pope John Paul II to intercede for a miracle in family court. When Benedictus later told me he was confirmed by Pope John Paul II, my conviction to eliminate court for all families was sealed. Citing the Bible, our Minnesota Supreme Court stated, "It is difficult to adjudicate with the wisdom of King Solomon when both parties are willing to split the baby. Children should not become pawns in the wars of adults. When the law states that the best interests of children should guide the courts, then children must be the beneficiaries of justice, not the gavel pounding out the acrimony existing between adults. A child is a gift from God and precedes all human legislation and is superior to it. Parental rights do not exist because we have custody laws. To the contrary, parental rights existed beforehand, are fundamental, and cause us to make laws in the first place, laws to protect family liberty, not to restrict it. It is only natural to add the presumption of joint physical custody to the presumption of joint legal custody, which is what this important legislation does. The United States Supreme Court ruled in Troxell that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution provides fit parents have a constitutional right to make decisions regarding the care, custody, and control of their children. This means that parents have had a fundamental right to make decisions regarding their children's upbringing since 1868. The United States Supreme Court has consistently acknowledged a private realm of family life which the state cannot enter. Equal rights are fundamental, God-given rights that separating fit parents already have before any court filing relating to their family. Legislation reflecting that will virtually end all custody litigation, leaving courts available for child protection and enforcement of custody rights. Think about it. Family court is the only place where civil contracts between disputing family members become court orders subject to contempt. Myself and my clients founded the Family Innocence Project, dedicated to eliminating court for all families. The United States Supreme Court stated that the history and culture of Western civilization reflects a strong tradition of parental concern for the nurture and upbringing of their children. This primary role of parents in the upbringing of their children must be established beyond a reasonable doubt and beyond debate as an enduring American tradition. God bless families and God bless America.
Thank
Vote
you,
yes for HF 322.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. We have time for just one more testifier. Ms. Olson, would you like to call someone else up to testify?
I know Kim cannot be here Thursday, and her testimony is very short.
All right. Please step forward, take a seat at the testifiers table, introduce yourself, and again, I would remind everyone that 10 a.m. is our adjournment time, but we will let you conclude your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kimberly Hanlon, and I am an attorney practicing law in both Minnesota and Oklahoma. Oklahoma has a rebuttable presumption for equal parenting time, which is intended to keep the status quo as much as possible for children during and after the divorce process. And the presumption is similar to that proposed in House File 322. Oklahoma applies the presumption to temporary orders, whereas House File 322 contemplates applying the presumption to final orders as well as temporary orders. Because of Oklahoma's equal parenting time presumption, most cases do not require a temporary order hearing regarding custody and parenting time, and a vast majority of the families are able to work out a parenting time schedule on their own and submit it as an agreed order. Most of the time, that agreement is tweaked a little bit and reflected in the final order as well. So you can see how much litigation gets eliminated from that presumption. In the cases where there is abuse, neglect, or an absent parent, the presumption is easily rebutted. I understand opponents of this bill are framing it as being counter to a child's right to protection, but that seems unfounded to me as I've operated in and seen this presumption work in practice in another state. Let's be clear. No court wants to send a child to an abusive or neglectful parent. The presumption that both parents should continue to parent their children is a fair one in most cases. When custody is at issue and litigation ensues, parents wage war in a winner-takes-all game. This does not serve families well, and children are hurt in the crossfire. Reducing the opportunity to escalate family conflict serves everyone except the family law attorneys. And I should know because I am one. Since I would rather serve families than myself, I am in favor of House File 322. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hanlon. Representative Scott, closing comments for today, and I would remind everyone that this bill will be laid over and picked up again Thursday of this week, February 23rd. We'll continue the discussion.
Well, thank you for the committee's time this morning, Mr. Chair, and just look forward to the board discussion.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And for those of you that did not get to testify today, we will make arrangements. If you would like to be on the calendar for testimony on Thursday, contact our committee legislative assistant, and he will put you on our agenda. With that, this committee is adjourned.